Blog Talk Radio.
Tones of J. Oliver's 1924 West End Blues. I want to share with you so much today. It's a pleasure to have what I'm referring to as the aesthetic Mason. These are the types that are the aesthetics are the types that frequent this program. And frequent programs like it, and this kind of information, the aesthetics. So we'll talk a bit about that later. I think you're going to find that your ability to and your interest in what's going on around us is being challenged by some unsettling rhetoric. And I think it's unsettling because it really runs, it's a contradiction to masonry, to the principles, a sense of common good. Whether or not you're resigned to the notion of the savagery of humanity, it's troubling when in those intervals of peace and harmony that happen in between quarrels by despots and so-called leaders leads us into despair. It's a shout out today to our brethren in the Sudan, suffering a widespread famine that's allegedly putting over 2 million people at risk of death. And it's said that this was preventable, except the war that goes on in that nation has brought both sides to a point where they've lost their reason, and the killing continues, and the starvation continues. And I don't know, you and I are equipped with some lofty and essential principles, but you and I know that a man needs to come to masonry of his own free will and accord. We can't inject these principles into the lives of anybody. But in the meantime, we have an incredible narrative today. The best of everything is masonry. I'll make that argument and see if I can convince you of that. But as we listen to West End Blues, it's the opening opening song for this program has been since the start. A little bit of trivia here that I'll throw in that has to do with a singer by the name of Eleonora Fagan. She was Eleonora. Was about 13 when she first, we think, when she first heard that song, the introduction, West End Blues, but with Louis Armstrong riffing on the trumpet in a way that had never been heard before. Now, Eleanor was born in 1915, so that would have made this about 1928, wouldn't it? After the First World War, in between the wars, she was a woman born in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, and she went on to be enormously famous. She was interviewed a number of years ago before her death. She died in 1959, July 17th, by the way, and asked about her, the influences on her. Now, some of you who are musicologists and fans of the type will remember the name Bessie Smith. She is, what would you say, a Delta blues belter, the big voice singer. Billie Holiday was able to sing at the time and was influenced by Bessie Smith and thought that she would like to have that, you know, she would like to be following on in the same strain. But she didn't have the big voice. Her voice, Eleonora's voice, didn't equip itself to the kind of style of Bessie Smith. And who does? And who did? But when she was 13, she heard Louis Armstrong in this song "West End Blues," and she was influenced and claimed in her adult life that her style was influenced by Louis Armstrong's playing and Bessie Smith's, and she found a balance somewhere between those two enormous talents. Now, Eleonora was known professionally as Billie Holiday. Here. Billie Holiday. Influences. Connections. Know what I mean? Not exactly a belter. Billie Holiday. Speaking from a time that where there's some disgraceful things happening to people of color, but maybe there's some kindred spirits out there, people who can relate to what it feels like when they're being hated because of what they are, not who they are. How do you accept that, separate that out? I don't know. Today we need to talk to you a little bit about with a frame of reference, and the frame of reference is Immanuel Kant. We've spoken about Immanuel Kant before on the program. He was a, what would you say, philosopher?
Yeah.
Very difficult to understand. Very difficult to understand because of the way that he wrote. And there's not, and that perhaps speaks to why there's not a lot of translation. But I was absolutely captured. You're going to hear about this in next week's program. This is a derivative. It wasn't that this is a direct a quotation, but we do know that Kant liked order. He's a big fan of it. And here's something that Durant reflected on Kant's ideas. In a footnote, he mentioned that he summarized and tried to reframe Immanuel Kant's sense that science is organized knowledge. Wisdom is organized life. And I thought that's rather remarkable. But what I found really fascinating was a quote from a newspaper in 1955, and it printed an excerpt written by a Texas sculptor named Raoul Jossette. And he carried on the idea, if wisdom is organized life and science is organized knowledge, art is organized beauty. I just think that this is... I think we can give Kant credit for the ideas, and it speaks. I think it has a bearing on things Masonic. We search for balance so often, very often, and we're going to talk about that today. The audience here, the balance of this audience is certainly. Spreading. Make no mistake about that. We have listeners, a big portion of our listeners coming now from France and Australia. Shout out to our listeners, Masonic and otherwise, from Australia and Norway. And thank you very much for the support of here in North America. Always welcome, always. Now, I want to talk with you a lot, need some more advice from you, brethren, global or otherwise. The ideas that are Freemasonry are not contained on some page or within some constitution. They're not. They're more like the wind. They are influenced by different forces. They have a direction. They can be predicted up to a sense. But the boundaries that mankind has created mean very little to the wind. Mankind, humanity, and the industry that it's created can influence those winds, but not nearly as much as the topography and the orbit of the Earth. And so it's part of a long process, depending on your level of abstraction. But I need you to, I'd like you to have a sense of the balance of Masonry at that point between, you know, the infinite past, the Egyptians loved, and the infinite future that the Egyptians loved, and that small point in between, the now, the present, where you and I exist, where you and I function in the moment. The others simply exist in our imagination. Our history are simply memories, nothing more than that. But I want to talk to you about that and something that you've all experienced, I think, called déjà vu. Déjà vu, a very, very nice term for it. Chances are you've experienced it before, in which case one thing is for sure, you remember what it's like. Ironic, because the essence of déjà vu is a failure to remember. Déjà vu is that hidden, vivid feeling that whatever you are and whatever you're doing, you've been there and experienced that situation before, even though you have no actual memory of it. Now, I'm not talking about the geniuses out there, gentlemen, the ones that are standing there and they're being bracing for the barrage of well-deserved vitriol and temper from their partner. I'm not talking about that, where you're sitting there saying, gee, I've been here before. You would think I would learn, but oh no. The ones that we have complete culpability, where we're completely and utterly guilty of whatever is coming our way. That's not what I'm talking about here. That's more in the conversation about male stupidity and why there are more women on the earth than men, primarily because boys tend to do stupid stuff. Even though you have no actual memory of this, you have that sense. Technically, there are several, did you know? Of course you did. That there are several slightly different versions of déjà vu, including déjà vécu, the feeling of having lived through an event, vécu. Déjà senti, the feeling of having already felt a particular emotion. Déjà vite, the feeling of knowing a place you've never visited before. Déjà pensé, the feeling of having had the same thought before. Oh, it's broken down, yeah. You're not alone in this. Do writers ever have déjà écrivé? You've written it before. Despite the shades of gray, each variation is about the same sort of experience. So consider this example. You walk into a room full of people, and as your attention is pulled one way and then another, you briefly notice a lamp on a table. And later, as the crowd thins, you get a better look at the lamp and think, I've seen that before, which expands to overwhelm you with the feeling that you've actually been in that room before. It might only be a momentary occurrence. As that instant feeling of familiarity fades so quickly, often because you're busy trying to remember what's happened in the first place. You think, where was I when something like this happened previously? What is it that's so familiar about this situation? So rationally, you know that you haven't really been in the situation before, but something's going on in your brain to make you think you have. So déjà vu is a frustrating psychological occurrence. It's estimated that roughly 2 out of every 3 people have experienced it. Despite how common it is, it's very poorly understood. Even the experts, the neuroscientists and psychologists and psychiatrists acknowledge they don't have a precise handle on it. So there's room for you to weigh in on this. But they could also say that they're sort of getting closer to understanding and refining new ideas. So given the lack of exact science, it isn't surprising that we have poets and authors to thank for many of the most vivid descriptions of the déjà vu experience. In the best description category, there's David Copperfield in Charles Dickens' classic tale. We have all some experience of a feeling that comes over us occasionally of what we are saying and doing, having been said and done before in a remote time, of our having been surrounded dim ages ago by the same faces and objects and circumstances, of our knowing perfectly what will be said next, as if we suddenly remembered it. the déjà vu, you'll realize that Dickens' observations are right. But it's the part about knowing what will come next that's really troublesome. How many people actually feel that level of clairvoyance? And how long does that feeling last? If someone says something and you think you know what he or she is going to utter next, then you should be able to predict the next statement. But there's no proof that the feeling of a prediction leads to actual predictions. So Dickens' references to dim ages ago may be, as countless others have suggested when it comes to déjà vu, evidence of reincarnation. Of course, reincarnation would be a simple, straightforward explanation if it weren't for two major stumbling blocks. First, there's no credible proof that reincarnation is possible. And second, if one did previously experience an identical situation dim ages ago, how likely is it that it would be remembered? Honestly, I have trouble remembering breakfast yesterday. Did I have breakfast here? Yeah. What you had. So think about a conversation that you could have had in your living room today, and then imagine a previous life in which you might be sitting in front of a campfire, dressed in your filthy, lice-ridden woolens. Nothing like the past to make me feel good. And be a little bit wet and smelly, as if you were of a higher social standing, sitting in front of the fireplace, dressed in your fashionable, lice-ridden woolens. It's unlikely that the conversation you had in the dim past would have been about binge-watching Breaking Bad. Rather than reincarnation being the explanation, perhaps déjà vu led to the very idea of reincarnation in the first place. Actually, electrochemical misfiring isn't a justification for researching the paranormal. So we're going to, nearly 100 years ago, Edward Titchener suggested that déjà vu was a result of a broken sequence of thoughts. Imagine he suggests you look both ways before crossing the street, and just for a second, your attention is caught by the display in a store window. I've been on this street before, when you think. Titchener's argument was that the original left-right look is separated in your mind from the actual crossing. And another possibility is that the process of memory making and memory retrieval, which most of the time are independent, occasionally happen simultaneously, resulting in a feeling of remembering a situation you're actually experiencing for the first time. This was once likened to having the record and playback heads of a tape recorder active at the same time. But the tape recorder analogy isn't a great one anymore, because who remembers what a tape recorder was? It's like trying to explain to somebody what a typewriter was. Anyway, déjà vu. We'll be back. Thank you. Of course it would be French. After a talk on Deja Vu, of course, what else? It had to be a music from France. Here's a little bit on an amazing, I think a really interesting commentary today. And I need some feedback on it. This is a summary of what you've been talking to me about. I listened very seriously, and you seem to be saying to me that Masonry is the best of everything in a way. It also is like saying that the best things in life are free. I don't know if free means that you don't have to work for them or you don't have to apply yourself. There doesn't have to be any self-discipline. One would have to be mad to accept the challenges of self-improvement in a secular environment, no? You'd have to be really out of it. Is it so wrong to pick up the utensils left behind by people we have not known at a time when the mists of time have relevance? Confusion, of course. Confusion. Who could sit at this feast without confusion? Why ever would we tamper with a poor fool's self-consciousness? And if we are on board when we launch ourselves off, we don't even know where this ship is headed. Is it sufficient to head off toward aspiration, hope, and the cruelest of all taskmasters, self-improvement? Is that enough? So many questions that we can't learn until we defeat one of the great warriors of existence. Silence. So is it within the grasp of a man in the market to be cultured so that he can have a choice that a privileged man can never know? Choices that define the best of everything. I can't tell you that the best music is jazz or classical, voice or instrumental. Is a feast of garden-grown sweet potatoes and chicken with delightful company surrounded by a good drink, good music on a summer's evening, better than a night at the opera before dining at a fine restaurant? Or is it true the Mason in me can be completely happy with whatever circumstance caused him? Where is the contentment to be found? Well, it's obvious. Masonry is a product of imagination and curiosity and patience. Masonic literature is about as defining as saying what has been written is as important as what will be written. The best of everything is to move through life competing only with oneself, with tolerance and perseverance, with the business of a work in progress. And in that way, happiness is about being. So why, I say to myself, are you living? I want to know if the audience of Masonic Effects are the aesthetics. It's a term that came from Germany, yeah, by a philosopher by the name of Alexander Baumgarten in his dissertation in 1735. Back in the day, 18th century. And it's more, if you want to get into, you know, just increasing the understanding of the term, it's a study of sensory, of, you know, emotional values, the judgments of sentiment. Living the life of an aesthetic is what I think happens to many Masons. Yes, I'm sitting here with a big pile of sneezorama. passing from winter into spring is just this wonderful process. I don't know, I blame it on Egypt. You know, there's the highest goal of man on earth is to live in an aesthetic life based on, this is a paraphrase of Timothy Leary, based on the dance. The idea of an aesthetic lifestyle happens with a person who lives dedicated to developing the body through training, through a clean diet, a good diet, and they live in a way that's finds balance. Not everybody lives that way. We see people in India, a country that's no longer self-conscious of its religious aspects. People living a particular life that defines them, their dedication and their focus in a way that is unique in these grand populations of billions of people. What does a homeless or a poor person do to define themselves? Well, nothing interferes with your sense of translating faith and the benefits of connecting with your creator, or an understanding of the purpose of life. Nothing interferes with that except your own commitment. It's more than just existing. These are people who are living. And are they any more or less productive than you or I? So we can do that. We can live an aesthetic life. It improves our mental health, can make us happier and more relaxed, can change our focus and lift our moods. And by doing that, it will positively affect the people around us. If you find yourself consumed by irritation and dread and fearfulness, realize that those things are choices. Those aspects are choices that you are making. It's not the way the world is. It's the way you're seeing it. Where is it getting you? That's not necessarily the Masonic way. Self-improvement is about self-awareness. How to do that without facing self-consciousness, I don't know. We have to get our minds around that. The aesthetic life of a Mason is acknowledging the things in life that we consider beautiful. And then we find things that appeal and attract our interest. It allows us to further explore. So I'll give you an example here. There are expectations that come with our obligations. So those explanations mean that it is important, if you choose to take on this task of development, to understand your culture. Now, to understand your culture is to do a couple of things. It's to examine your assumptions, to examine and assess what's going on around you today, but also to become a student of your cultural history. the things that influenced and created the processes that evolved into what's going on around us in this moment. And we all have different histories. We all come at the points, our points of immediacy and the in the present from different directions. We're not in lockstep. We don't all have the history that led up to a particular form of democracy. We have many. Oh, by the way, there are different forms of democracy, just like there are different forms of dictatorships or despots or, you know, the autocrats or the oligarchs or, you know, there's different forms of it. They take different shapes. They may all come from the same rootstock and shapes. So it's important, if you choose this kind of task, to be a student, to be familiar. That means going beyond what you know to beginning understanding what it is you know. Otherwise, we're just sort of leaking opinions that really don't have much depth. And we need to go a little bit beyond, as a Mason, go a little bit beyond the superficial. So we can arrive at self-improvement on our own by stumbling along like that pebble in the ubiquitous brook being driven by the currents, stronger in the spring when the water runoff is greater, more laconic in the summer when it's the pools, the deep pools hold all the little trout. Yeah. But nevertheless, these small pebbles moving in a particular direction. Well, you could do it that way, or we can think about the ideas of Immanuel Kant. Maybe you're not as rigid or dedicated or the aesthetic that he was. That's not for anybody to impose as the ideal. But what part of the ideas that he was talking about makes sense? This notion of life being organized wisdom, science being organized thought, ideas. Hmm? And art being organized beauty. Well, it seems to make some sense. Who does the organizing? Well, let me say that I would hope that that's in the eye of the beholder, in your mind's eye. Not to take something vulgar and try and elevate it to the status of something noble. How we do that has to do more with our presence. And we already know, we already get it if we look for it. We already get it. What's the point? What's the point going on around us? Is it to be powerful? Really? That's a bit ridiculous. Then we should all be afraid of 14-year-old ghetto kids with guns. Is that the defining statute of life for a Mason? Doing the best one can. Being content with what one has. Striving audaciously. Moving ahead. So is science in your mind organized knowledge? Well, that means, that suggests, doesn't mean, you decide what it means, but it suggests a task, an opportunity to understand a little bit about science, a little more about science than what we hear coming through the social media. Now, you think about the enormity of the material available to any one of us. It's not like, where do we start? What's your imagination? Where does your imagination take you? What part of existence doesn't include science? we can start very easily with sort of obvious things. Very, very basic stuff. What's air? What am I breathing? What is light? How come I don't fly off the face of my chair into outer space? How come people around the world speak different languages? How come there are some languages that lend itself to beauty and art and others that don't? I don't know that. Is it our essential nature? Is violence our essential nature as a human being, as this creature? I strive for contentment. I don't know what that is. I strive for happiness. Not sure what that is. That's an emotion. I'm not really sure how my brain and mind get to this sense of happiness and contentment. And what's a sense of humor? What's a temper? What's the course of decisions and choices that lead me to be irritable? Is irritability linked to anxiety? What's anxiety? Or do something much more creative if you choose. How do the walls of my house stand up? What are the influences of Euclidean geometry? What about Mandelbrot geometry? What's that about? The geometry of the shape of a cloud or the cascade of a wave. You mean there's geometry involved in this? Why was I taught that mathematics and sciences were hard and necessary, and only smart people thought of it, were able to accomplish that, and the arts were weak? The humanities were inessential. Social sciences were trivial. When in fact, what governs my life more directly is my sense of ethics, values, a sense and understanding of the intrinsic and extrinsic. You're saying we'll do well without economic theory? Really? Well, of course I agree, but I don't have an alternative. Let's just do away with whatever system we've got, some variation on a capitalist system, some variation on what? Free market situation? I don't know. Is there no end? What's beauty? What is sound? What's music? What's mathematics? Where did it come from? The easy stuff. We don't have to necessarily, I can't tell you what time is, but it sort of fascinates me. Well, it was constructed. So was language. That's a human construct. When I walk in the woods, the trees aren't talking to me. Well, maybe some ways they are. So the Mason in us is looking for some consistency with his values, with principles. And I doubt that we can achieve those unless we know what they are. And we certainly can't tell whether we've achieved and been successful in creating a life, living a life according to those values, in other words, organizing our life in order to achieve happiness. Is it possible to achieve happiness in a chaotic, or is the alternative to organization chaos? Well, no. It's like saying the alternative to peace is war. No. It's like saying the alternative to argument is acquiescence. No. That doesn't quite work when we sit down and think about it. Deep breath, what's the point? Self-development. Now, what do you do to develop? You learn. What do you need in order to learn? Curiosity. Where is it taking you? You may never know. But along the way, we can refer to it as that ubiquitous bloody journey. Ugh. Life is a journey. Life is a journey. I hope you well on your Masonic journey. Da, 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 da. It's like saying the wind is on a journey. I don't think so. These are just things you pay attention with. And will everybody around you be reflecting your attitude? Hell no. No, of course not. You have different history, different perspective, a different way of looking at masonry, and a different way of looking at yourself. The self-improvement part? Well, when I sit down with you in Norway, I hope that you'll tell me a little bit about, you'll tell me a lot about, and not be overwhelming, but be thoughtful of my curiosity. I hope you'll be able to tell me about the things that are shining stars of your culture, the highlights. Is there music or is there philosophy? Of course there is, I know this, but is there music and philosophy and is there architecture? And what's the quality of life like and how did you get there? And how are you facing some of the current insults to your culture, the intrusions, the threats, and how do you battle that out? Is that a battle? A struggle, yeah. Or in France, see, or in Australia, listeners in Australia, will you tell me about the popular sort of superficial history of Australia, but of what it means to you, how it affects you as a Mason, and how Masonry has influenced your life as an Australian. Be very interested to hear, does your sense of the principles of Masonry linger in the air the way it does here? And how is Masonry in Australia or Canada or the United States reinvent itself? How are all of us handling this challenge of bringing forward that echo, being able to hear that echo from the past? It's not that we have control over it. It's not that we understand enough of it that we can pretend to say that this is the echo and I'm going to pass this one on. It's all these voices and all these minds joining all these tiny worlds of air joining into a wind. And it comes at a price, doesn't it? In your mind, is it possible for a wind that began back in the 15th century to have imparted an effect that's still present today? Well, yeah, I don't want to do the mathematics, but I get the idea. Something was passed forward, always passed forward, never passed backwards. So somebody would have told me that the best of Masonry was in the past. I don't accept that. I just find that very difficult because I don't have a comparator. All I can compare that to is where it's going. And how are we doing at this point under the scrutiny of social media and being able to dissect and overthink? We're doing all right. We're doing better than we ever have before. Is there the type of a trauma event that's going to bring us together in great numbers again? I hope not. I hope not. I don't want men and women to have to cling in fear to each other while their lives are in the hands of, you know, the roll of a dice, whether they're going to be killed or the next man or the next man. We can answer that whole question about women in Masonry. Will there it's not why there are no women in history. That's a wind that began a long time ago, and it is what it is, or was what it was. And it's moving toward that day, that ethic, where women will be incorporated in masonry in all aspects. But the issue here isn't that. Not a thumbs up, thumbs down. It's how. And right now, frankly, I don't see how. How to do it. And not to be frivolous about it, how do we do that? It's not as simple. Yeah, I guess you could take a sword and cut the Gordian's knot, yeah? But I don't know how. We don't, collectively. So that wind has also blown through the lodges of women's groups, and now we have entire organizations of women organized and seeming to flourish, and good masons. And I think that's a good thing. Now, am I so caught up in the authority of masonry? I think it's very important, as you know, that we have the safety and preservation of our Constitution. Now, how we translate the Constitution decade by decade does change. And I know there will be older people that have been bypassed out there, but very, very rigid people who think that they can stop change from happening. As we hear in some Mideastern countries, we don't like change, we don't want change, we will stop change. Well, these are people that have a perspective, their own perspective. And you and I, as Masons, would need to be able to fully address that pressing question, can change, can progress be stopped? How's that been working for us in the past? Here's a little bit of something quite beautiful. This is by Esbjørn Svendsen Trio. I think it rocks. This is 7 Days of Falling. Check it out. Thank you. Refill your tumbler. I hope listening to Masonic Effects has put you in helped you achieve a state of calm and reflection. I hope you've been purposeful. It's been a pleasure having you here. Sorry, Norway, this is as close as I could get to jazz in Norway today. I'll work on it. I know there's good jazz in Norway. Don't kid yourself. This is a Swedish trio. But it was just fascinating. Listen to the music, eh? I hope you'll come back and join us. I hope you will. We'll look forward to having you here with us again. And to see us out today. Here I'm facing a spring day. I've got to fill up my glass with a little, I think a Riesling, and then we'll retire to the table outside and pick it up from there. In the meantime, this will rock your world just a little bit. This is a group called the Hot Sardines, and you'll pick up the German in it.
Of all the boys I've known and I've known some. First met you with lonesome. Came inside of my heart, grew like the world was new to me. Just well, I'll admit you deserve expressions that fit you. Rack my brain hoping to explain things you do to me. By me, this be shame. Please let me explain. By me, this be shame means that you're grand. By me, this be shame. Again and again, me and the other fairest in the land. I could say fella, fella, even say for the Irish language I'm leaking out of the shop. How wonderful you are, I try to. By me, if it's a shame, so kiss me, so you'll understand. Thank you. kiss me, oh, kiss me. Thank you.